When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Everyone knows what it's been like living in America after the Supreme Court handed down its Dobbs decision. But can we imagine, do we dare imagine, a life after Dobbs, a post-Dobbs America? I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and welcome to Justice by Design. Don't forget to subscribe and follow and give 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. And today, I am joined by Rachel Rebuchet. She is the Dean of Temple Law School, and she's also a Professor of Reproductive Healthcare Law. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want you to introduce yourself a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about the work that you do there at Temple.
So, you know, when I am teaching, I teach in contracts, healthcare, finance and regulation and family law, but I also teach a reproductive justice seminar. And that's the area that I've been researching my entire career and writing about. And since Dobbs and just before it, with some terrific co-authors, trying to map what the legal landscape will look like after Roe v. Wade has been overturned. And most recently, I've been focused on what does abortion access mean in an era where people are increasingly ending their pregnancies with pills? So what are the state's efforts to try to stop pills? What are efforts to try to keep people from ordering them? What are the efforts to try to shut down the virtual clinics that have aided the proliferation of pills? And what are people doing in the opposite? So that's the research I've been working on for the last year or two. And I've turned my attention to medical education and what's happening to the standard of obstetric care after Dobbs.
I really can't wait to dive into that more with you. It was actually a conversation about that when we met that gave me the idea to have you on for this podcast episode. So I want to talk a little bit. I'm sure many of our listeners know what has been happening in the 2 years since Dobbs came down. But if we needed a reminder, we needed only to look at an AP report this very week that talked about women, some of whom were in danger of bleeding out, being unable to access emergency care when they were pregnant. And this comes even though there is a federal law called EMTALA that makes it a requirement for any medical facility that receives federal funding to give stabilizing emergency care to all patients, regardless of what that care is, including abortion care. So, Rachel, explain to us how we are still seeing this. When I went to law school all those many years ago, I learned that federalism said federal law supersedes any state law. We had an opportunity for the Supreme Court to clarify things, and it didn't. How did we end up here?
So, you know, it's such a good question because EMTALA was a piece of federal legislation that was passed bipartisan, and it was meant to keep hospitals from patient dumping, from showing up at an ER, not having money to pay for care, and a hospital turning you away. So your exactly right. What it requires is for an ER to stabilize you. If you come with an emergency, the ER has a federal duty to make sure that you're transferred to a place that can give you the care if they can't, but in any instance, that they stabilize that emergency to protect your life and health. And there's some definition about what that means, but it's a concept we'd all probably, I think that most of us think this makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
The problem with these abortion bans, Idaho, Texas, those laws are that ban abortion from conception, they don't have exceptions for medical emergency. So you are acting illegally in some instances or under some interpretations if you are a provider and you are trying to treat someone in an emergency and what they need is an abortion in order to save their lives or, you know, now these laws have life exceptions, but that's the conflict. And just to your point, the Biden-Harris administration issued guidance through its agency to say, this is the very reason we have this law. ERs be on notice, hospitals be on notice that where Texas law or Idaho law conflicts with this federal mandate, you got to follow the federal mandate. You need to stabilize people who are you're treating in your ER, even if it means that that treatment necessitates abortion. And so what we saw in Moyle was Idaho say no, there's no conflict here. A law that doesn't require anyone to treat you in a medical emergency, A-OK. And as you said, the Supreme Court has kicked it back to the lower courts, which does nothing for women and pregnant people in Texas who are still subject to another decision that held there is no conflict between the Texas law and EMTALA, that EMTALA doesn't preempt the Texas abortion ban. So, you know, pregnant people in Idaho have a better shot at receiving emergency abortion care. People in Texas don't have that confidence. They don't have that assurance. And it's created such confusion. I mean, the one of the consequences of this is just to chill care across the board when no one knows what law applies, how to apply it. Yeah.
And it's just to broaden it out a little bit, because we're talking about pregnant people. I mean, the argument in the Moyle case was gobsmacking to me at times, because there were questions about, oh, well, what if somebody is depressed about the fact that they're pregnant? And, you know, would emergency, you know, if they're suicidal, would emergency care be an abortion? It's like, what world? Like, what doctor with a license that wouldn't be challenged would say, oh, look, I have this depressed patient. I know. I mean, they need an abortion. Like, that is a problem exactly nowhere. The standard care would be to give them emergency psychiatric care to stabilize them until they can talk to their practitioner or their own medical or mental health care professional. But I digress. The real problem, actually, if you want to expand it, that's not how it's expanded. It's expanding by the fact that even people who are not seeking out abortions, people who had no intention of getting an abortion, somebody who perhaps had an ectopic pregnancy, which often requires life-saving care, someone who had a complication that they need emergency care in order to preserve their fertility, someone who may, gosh forbid, be a cancer patient or someone. There are so many people, including people who probably would be devastated by the fact that their care would be an abortion, but that in fact is the care that they need in order to save their bodies, save their lives, save their fertility. This is where the rubber is meeting the road. Nobody is giving depressed people, being forced to give depressed people an abortion under this federal law, right?
Well, so that's exactly what the Solicitor General said. Well, show me the physician in an ER who is going to terminate a pregnancy rather than try to intervene for what is the psychiatric indication first. And, you know, I think the issue that you're really highlighting is a deep disagreement about what medicine requires. So that is part of an argument that Idaho and Texas, they're making right out of the anti-abortion playbook, which is that you never need an abortion. There's no world in which anyone ever needs an abortion. The problem is that's just not factually true. That we, doctors, physicians, providers know that there are some complications with pregnancy, which pregnancy, you know, I know Justice Alito disagrees, but turns out it's not just gift, it is a burden. And so there's a spectrum of complications, some life-threatening, severe threat to health, some threat to the life that would result. You have on this spectrum fatal fetal anomaly, which the Texas and Idaho law don't contemplate. So what we ask women to do is to carry to term a pregnancy that will never survive, to give birth to a child that is not going to live. You know, these, just to your point, there are, the reason we have a standard of care in these terrible and unfortunate situations is because they vary and what people need vary. And what Dobbs has done in allowing states like Texas and Idaho to pass such narrow laws is they've essentially said to physicians, to ER docs, to family practice docs, to abortion providers, to OBs, you know, what you know, what, from your training, what you know is patient-centered care that can save fertility, that can protect someone's health, that can help safeguard the any child that's born. Suspend it. Suspend that knowledge and
have it be substituted by a judge.
Which, have it be substituted by a judge.
I mean, we saw what happens when a judge tried to substitute his view for that of the FDA when it came to mifepristone. That's not what judges are supposed to do, but this is precisely what's happening here. And not just judges putting themselves in the place of physicians, but now tell us a little bit about how judges are essentially now putting themselves in the place of medical educators.
So Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine is the case that you just mentioned, and it's the case where Judge Kaczmarek in Amarillo said to the FDA, you shouldn't have approved medication abortion, mifepristone, the first drug in a medication abortion, a quarter of a century ago in 2000, suspended that decision from almost 25 years ago. On the back of health and safety arguments that mifepristone's dangerous, people show up in the ER after they take it. By the way, problem, because you're also arguing in a different case that if people show up in the ER, there's no duty to treat them.
Right.
But let's
consistency pause. Is not always consistency is not always a virtue in this realm.
Yeah. That's a different case, but yeah. So that people suffer mental health problems after abortion. There's just all this evidence about mifepristone's danger, the dangerousness of it. And that's the same problem. I mean, water isn't wet, the sky isn't blue. There's no track record that, one, those things are true, but there's a very strong track record for safety and efficacy for this drug.
Right.
So how do we engage in litigation where courts are sympathetic to arguments that have no basis in scientific or medical evidence?
Yeah. So I wanna just hit on one more point before we talk about some of the solutions that you and some others are talking about to this, because that's what this podcast is all about, right? Rethinking, reimagining the solutions to the issues that we're facing. When we talked about how it's impacting the way medicine is being taught and what the, I was really shocked when you talked about what the consequences of that should be. Tell us more about that.
So The medical education for people, for OBs that have, they are required by the accrediting agency to receive family planning training, which includes abortion. Yet, if you're in a state that bans abortion and you're a resident at a teaching hospital, there are no abortion patients, how are you getting training to cover what is has been deemed by the accrediting agency, the professional organization for all OBGYNs, regardless of whether or not you want to provide abortions? You can opt out. You have a federal right to opt out if you want. But it is considered basic, standard OB knowledge for the reasons that Moyle brings up. If you are in a rotation in an ER and someone is admitted and they need emergency care, which requires an abortion, ectopic pregnancy, then you are responsible for knowing how to provide that care, absent some refusal, right? So these residents, for example, they're not getting that training. So they're having to do a few different things. They're having to travel. They're having to go out of state to intense courses in other states where abortion is legal, which is not at all how residencies work. I mean, usually this kind of training is incorporated throughout your time as a resident.
Right.
They're relying on simulations. So instead of seeing a patient and treating a real person, you're relying on models and other tutorials that try to simulate the patient care experience. This is going to create ripple effects that we're going to feel for decades. And we haven't even talked about yet that the number of people who want to be OBs is dropping.
Oh my goodness. There's so the ripple effect is none of us is going to have as good of healthcare. Whether we want to have children or not, it's going to affect everyone, whether you live, especially the overall drop in care. I mean, I found it very difficult to find a really good GYN in the best of times to find a good one as a result of a dwindling number of people even wanting to be bothered to get involved in this because the legal landscape is such a mess. That's going to lead to I can only imagine what that means to maternal health care, the maternal mortality rates, to people with conditions like preeclampsia, people like me at fibroids. I mean, how are people supposed to have good care?
You know, you've raised the problem that has plagued this country before Dobbs and remains even, it's getting worse. That's maternal health deserts.
Wow.
You can't find OBGYN, care because we're seeing both the practice of what one author called hesitant medicine, practicing in these areas where is this legal, is this not? And a default response is to not provide if you're not sure what the law requires or if you're going to be acting outside the law. And then people who are just refusing to go to those states, who are moving out of states that already have a healthcare crisis for pregnant people, people who are electing to not go into the field at all.
Wow.
And that is, people are still going to become pregnant in this country and they're still going to need OBGYNs.
Yes.
And we could see that workforce really hit very hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even if they don't, I mean, I knew I never wanted to give birth, but I still needed GYNs for a lot of reasons for my whole life. So I want to talk about solutions now. I'm so glad I have you here because you, are along with co-authors David Cohen and Greer Donnelly wrote a piece that I loved because it wasn't just another piece about how to handle the Dobbs landscape. It was about how do we get past Dobbs. and yeah. how that is not an if, that needs to be a when, and when needs to be as soon as possible. And you all outline the way to overturn Dobbs. And the first, I love the first point. I want to spend a little bit of time on that. How you get there is it has to start with the public discourse. We have to treat Dobbs like it is temporary. Talk a little bit more like that about that.
We have to think of Dobbs as a terrible decision, to use the words of Dobbs, egregiously wrong the day it was decided, egregiously wrong now. And it contorts history and tradition. It envisions a country in which pregnancy isn't financially and physically disabilitating to so many who are not given the right resources, the proper resources to decide when and whether to parent. And we know that people who end pregnancies, the reasons they give for ending a pregnancy is because they don't have the resources they need to raise the children they have. And so there is so much in the Dobbs opinion that is just blind to the reality of what abortion means to the people who need it in this country. And we should just be pressing those points every time we talk about Dobbs as a decision that is a temporary blip in a history of how we have talked about and had the Supreme Court protect fundamental rights. Let's all back up and just start talking about Dobbs as the mistake we knew was the mistake when it was decided, and is going to, as time moves on, just the examples that you were giving earlier in our conversation, they're going to become so stark and so overpowering that I have to believe that we're going to collectively get to a point. Maybe I'm a delusional optimist, but we'll get to collectively a point where we're like, this is what this case brought us. Like, and we don't have to live with it.
No, we don't. And I love this optimism. And one thing I love about that point is, you know, the way to overturn Dobbs ultimately, of course, is through litigation and or a constitutional amendment that would do so. You can pass laws. Congress can pass laws to create better protections, but to get rid of Dobbs, to make Dobbs no longer the law of the land, you would need to do that through the courts or through a constitutional amendment. But just to that first point again, how we talk about it, the discourse, how we explain it, that also needs to be done so that the judges who are hearing these cases hear it, right? Because at this point, judges, I would imagine, they've never been super excited about talking and writing about abortion. But since Dobbs now, I would think that one impediment would be they're just as jittery as the doctors are to move on this. How do you make that case to the judges where this litigation to try to overturn Dobbs will be brought to make them have open ears to it?
You know, you've got to create a pipeline of cases. You've got to start somewhere of creating the type of counter precedent that judges can look to and can cite and can build upon. It's interesting. The anti-abortion movement never accepted Roe. It took them almost 50 years, but they started chipping away at it bit by bit, piece by piece. Mm-hmm. And they had a harder case to make in my mind, but they did it through judicial appointments in a lot, but they also did it by creating the type of precedents that those inclined to see Roe as illegitimate could look to and could cite. They created the foundation, mm-hmm. and it took them time, but it culminated in Dobbs.
So just because it's hard, I think this is such an important part of this discussion. And I think it's something that I get very frustrated with people on the left who tend to be daunted by things that are hard, you know, or daunted to or reticent to replicate the playbook of those on the right. And here is exactly what they ought to be doing. They should have the same discipline, the same planning, the same doggedness in not stepping down from a battle just because it's hard. And I would apply that both to the litigation to overturn Dobbs, as well as I'm guilty of this too. When people start talking about constitutional amendments, I'm like, oh, well, you know, that's not going to happen. You know, it's happened 27 times. So why can't it happen now? I am now totally, I've done a 180 on that. You do the work, you make that a priority, and then it gets done, right?
Yeah, I agree. So the an example that, I get in trouble for saying this. So the 2025 got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And one piece that got some attention, but not as much as some of the other pieces, Comstock. We have this 1873 law that has stayed on the books, but was an obscenity statute that criminalizes immoral and indecent things and materials, and includes included contraceptives and includes abortion. And the anti-abortion movement captured in 2025 has seized on this law that has not been enforced for over 100 years, and was never an abortion ban. Like, that's just clear from the history.
Yeah.
As, you know, should be interpreted by courts right now, nationwide abortion ban. So why aren't we talking about repealing this law?
Yep.
Well, because it's hard and it won't pass. And I agree with you 100%. You should make people say out loud that they support a law passed when women couldn't vote.
Yes.
When their yes. people were barred from when we had when a law that was used to throw people in jail for writing pamphlets on sexual health,
yep.
A law that targeted people who were critics of the law, a law that was racist, that was classist, that was, you should make them say out loud, yes, I want 1873 to govern 2024 and 2025 and beyond.
Yes.
I think there's something to that.
I think that is actually one of the simpler things about that, just to say that this law that is being openly talked about by people who want to make abortions more difficult in this country, more difficult to access, that should be repealed. Do you know, I actually had a Democratic strategist say to me, no, that's not a message that voters will understand. And I said, I think it's really simple. Yeah. I think you're doing it wrong.
I agree. You know why voters understand Roe? Because we explained it.
Yes.
That's why voters now, we talk about Roe all the time and yep. returning to Roe, which I also think is a mistake to talk about.
I think we're doing at least a part of this right here, in which is reframing the conversation, being very clear about what is happening here, believing what people are saying when they say they want to use the Comstock Act on day one of a Republican administration, looking at what has already happened with using essentially a litmus test and appointing conservative judges with the issue of abortion in mind, and just seeing that there needs to be this, the coming back from this isn't just going to happen with an election. Coming back from this isn't just going to happen with time. There needs to be the same energy spent on protecting, not just protecting the rights of pregnant people. Again, I have never been pregnant.
Me either.
But I have needed so much reproductive health care, mm-hmm. everything from, you know, precancerous cells on my cervix to fibroids to PCOS to other things that deeply affected my health and potentially my life. This is everybody. This is half the population, right? Because the same attack is not happening on, you know, the ability of men to ensure their prostate care. This is happening to our half of the population, and anybody on earth who's been born, it affects them too, right? Because my mom needed to have a healthy reproductive system just to have me or my brother. It doesn't matter who you are. It affects every single one of us. And we need to be able to say very simply what we want from our leaders and envision a better future. So, Rachel, Thank you so much for joining me. This has been such an important conversation. I know we could go on for an hour, but I will link this piece, which just makes it, it spells it out. It's easier said than done, I know, but it's an important roadmap that can help us get to a post-Dobbs world. And I thank you so much for writing it. And I thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one thing that ties directly to the conversation I just had with Rachel, which may not seem to at first blush, is what I've been thinking about a lot this week. And that is a comment from the Republican vice presidential nominee, who in the past interview agreed that the quote, whole purpose of the postmenopausal female, end quote, is to be a grandmother and help take care of grandbabies. Now, what does this have to do with Dobbs? A lot. First of all, I will start by saying using the word female in that way as a noun is a slur. Don't send me your dictionary screenshots. Don't send me your references saying that it is a noun. I get it grammatically, but the subtext of that word, particularly when describing women and their role in society and their value, is a choice. It's an important one that reduces women to their biological function. That has happened particularly to women of color. We hear it clearly. That's not even a dog whistle. It's a foghorn. So first of all, that was foul to begin with. But to the substance of it, where the vice presidential nominee was agreeing that the whole purpose of a woman once she is postmenopausal, and full disclosure, I am not in that club yet, but I've been issued an invitation and waiting for my membership to be approved, but that the whole value as a human, her whole value would only exist if she has given birth to someone who has then too become a parent. Doesn't matter what, you know, if she has cured cancer, doesn't matter if she has open businesses and employed lots of people. It doesn't matter if she's a thought leader that has helped lead research in engineering or other technologies. It doesn't matter if she's a loving friend and daughter and sister. It doesn't matter if she's a journalist with podcast. None of that is valuable. Only her value is found in the uterus. And the reason for that messaging is important, because that's the only way that a Dobbs world can continue to exist. Because legally, as we pointed out with Rachel, Dobbs makes no legal sense. It is legally untenable, and it is showing itself to be practically untenable because it is really having a major detrimental effect on gynecological care in America, and it is putting people's lives in danger and has already cost people their lives. It's unworkable in that sense, but it can only work as a concept if we keep women regulated and relegated in certain roles. If you are of reproductive age, you are a walking gestation machine because you don't have the right to control your own reproduction. Do you know where we have seen reproductive rights taken out as a necessity? It's to keep an underclass in certain societies. It certainly was a requisite to the imprisonment of human beings. But it's done in a way to keep women in a subservient role and to protect the patriarchy. And one reason that we're seeing the grandmas being elevated over every other person in that age. And listen, grandmas are great. My grandma was the best person in the world, and she would agree with everything that I'm saying if she were still alive. But the reason that we are only reducing older women to grandmas as being valuable is because if we value grandmas and everyone else for their full value, everything that they bring to the world, all of their power, then that kind of brings the patriarchy to its knees, and Dobbs can't sustain in a society like that. So I know a lot of people will say, this is an old interview. You're making too much out of it. He was just agreeing with what someone else said. It's being blown out of proportion. Don't miss it. Keep your eyes open. As Taraji P. Henson said, look it up because all of this matters. And as Justice Alito said in Dobbs, women are not without electoral power. No, we are definitely not. See y'all in November at the polls. And I will see you next week for another episode of Justice by Design. Don't forget to subscribe, like, follow, tell a friend, tell your mom, tell your grandma, and tell her she is more valuable than just having been a grandma. See you next week.